We've come to Beverly Hills, California to visit with the man who owns one of the greatest voices in radio, I think. He was the premier announcer and spokesman for so many radio shows and advertisers on the air that boggles the mind. We're delighted to be with you, Andre Baruch.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here. It's my own home.
And it's a lovely home.
Thank you.
Where did your radio career begin?
It began in Brooklyn, New York, as a studio pianist.
As a pianist?
Okay. Yes. Inadvertently, in applying for a job at CBS for a studio pianist job, I got on the wrong line. They were auditioning pianists on one line and announcers on another line. And I got on the shorter of the two lines because I didn't have time to wait. And when it came my turn, they handed me a piece of paper on which was written many foreign compositions, foreign composers, conductors. And since I had been born in Europe, I knew several languages, and I figured this must be an intelligence test. So I read it, and when I was finished, they said, we'll call you if we want you. The following week, they called me. And they said, you've got the job. I said, wonderful. Do I bring my own music, or do you have a library here? What? This kind of stunned the production chief, and he said, look, we have a lot of competent musicians here. You are hired as an announcer. Just lay off the musicians. And that was when I first found out I was an announcer.
Well, you did a pretty decent job of it, I suppose. You didn't even play the piano at that situation there.
No, I never touched it.
But yet you thought you were hired as a pianist.
Originally, I figured they must be hiring me as a musician. But they hired me as an announcer. That was at CBS. And the staff consisted of some of the greatest in the business. Harry Von Zell, Norman Brokenshire, Ted Husing, eventually Ken Roberts, Ralph Edwards, Mel Allen, Frank Gallup. Ad infinitum, the best in the business.
Absolutely.
21 top announcers.
And what was your first on-the-air assignment then it boggles the mind to think, a staff announcer at CBS. I imagine it must have been pretty impressive to you as well.
I don't think I knew enough about the business to be impressed. I was happy to have a job because in those days, the salary of $45 a week was really magnificent. $45 a week. Today, people won't clear their throats for that, including me. I should clear my throat out of their throat.
So what was your first week then? How did you, $45, what were you expecting?
They put me in a little room, about 10 feet square, and all I was to do was to punch a button after the announcer on the show said, this is the Columbia Broadcasting System. I would say, wait 15 seconds, and say, WABC? New York. In those days, WCBS was known as ABC because originally CBS was the Atlantic Broadcasting Company. And about 2 weeks on the job, here I was sitting in this small room, bored, when a young fellow walked in who was showing people on tour what CBS was all about. And he said, what are you doing? I said, I make station breaks. And I explained it. He said, wouldn't you like to be on the regular staff? And I said, yes, very much so. He said, what's your name? I told him, Andre Baruch. I said, can you do anything? You know anybody on the 20th floor, which was the executive floor? He said, well, we'll see. And he left. And about a week later, I looked at the schedule, and there I was, announcing regular shows. And a short time after that, oh, that's our clock.
That's the old clock on the wall, right?
The old clock on the wall.
Beautiful.
About a week after that, as I say, I was in the elevator with Harry Von Zell, an announcer named David Ross, wonderful announcer, and in walked this young man. And I grabbed him and said, hey, bud, thanks a lot. I'm on the regular staff. He said, that's great. I'm happy for you. And he got off at the 20th floor, and when we went up to the next floor, Von Zell turned to me and said, do you know him? I said, yeah, he's an old buddy of mine. He said, Bill Paley's an old buddy of yours? I said, who he? He said, he owns the place. I said, oh, my God. So I ran downstairs to to the 20th floor, got in past his secretaries, and apologized. I said, "Mr. Paley, I just didn't know. Please excuse me." Because he was then 28 years old,
mm-hmm,
you know.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, "Oh, that's all right." I said, "I didn't mean to call you Bud." He said, "You can call me Bud anytime." So I'm the only person in America who calls William S. Paley Bud.
That's a wonderful story. Well, he must have seen something in your talents that knew that that told him to move you forward.
I don't know. I never asked him. We've remained friends. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, when my son graduated, our son graduated from the University of Pennsylvania, he was the commencement speaker. And we talked over old times again, and I've always been a great admirer of Bill Paley.
Mm-hmm. Well, I can imagine.
First for starting me off in the business, or in the announcing business.
So you were doing station break. You mentioned something about you'd wait for the network announcer, I guess, to say the Columbia Broadcasting System, and you waited 15 seconds before you did the WABC ID.
Right.
Why did you wait 15 seconds?
Chuck, I wish you hadn't asked me that question. I don't remember.
Was there a musical runoff there after
they
played that?
Yes, there was always 30 seconds of music. And then you waited 15 seconds, I guess, for the rest of the stations to clear.
Other stations maybe were,
other stations on
were
the network.
Pulling out.
Yeah, pulling out. So you waited 15 mm-hmm. seconds for them to clear, and then you came in with your own local.
And then you, in effect, probably talked it up to the top of the hour again, or
no,
whatever the break was.
That was all I said.
That's all. And then there was more music behind you, probably?
Yeah.
Till the next show
I
started.
Paid no attention to what was happening.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I fell asleep in there.
Well, if you were in that little room with nothing to do but that.
I remember once when H.V. Kaltenborn, I don't know if that name means
certainly
anything to you, but a great commentator and a very clipped way of speaking. Mm-hmm. "Good evening, everybody. This is H.V. Kaltenborn." You know, very. And I had fallen asleep, and obviously I was going to be late with my little break, and somebody from Master Control came running in and tapped me on the shoulder and said, "Break, break, WABC, New York." And I promptly got drowsy again when the next show came on. About, oh, I guess 5 minutes before the end of the next show, the Master Control engineer, figuring I might have fallen asleep again, and he was right, I had fallen asleep, came in and tapped me on the shoulder to wake me up. And without waiting for anything, I punched the button and said, "Just as H.V. Kaltenborn is saying, the trouble with the USSR is..." I punched the button and said, "WABC, New York."
He never knew about that, probably.
I don't know. We never discussed it.
Well, then, once you got out of the booth, what kind of assignments did you have?
Oh, morning melodies mm-hmm. with, what's his name, Brusilov, conducting, and little shows, you know, little musical shows, sometimes introducing commentators, and that was it. Until I started to get soap operas, mm-hmm. like Just Plain Bill, John's Other Wife, which I once introduced as John's Wife, Wife's Other John, and I used to make a lot of mistakes in those days. I still do, as a matter of fact. I once opened a show with "Good ladies, evening, and gentlemen of the Audio Radiance." And some others that I cannot mention on the air. In any case, we did everything, which was why announcers in those days became more proficient and more versatile mm-hmm. than those of this era, because we did sports, we did commercials, we did sustaining programs, we did commentating, we did everything. And you just had to. And you had to be well-versed in languages and speak fairly clearly and distinctly. In those days, you really needed modulated tones.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that was the pear-shaped era, as we call it. And we had pear-shaped specialists. But in
any
case,
announcers were specialists, or there were people who were making sure that...
Well, in order to get a job as an announcer, mm-hmm. you had to speak with a rich, deep, mellifluous tone. Today, it's not so important. Today, they realize that salesmanship mm-hmm. is more important than speech pattern or vocal pattern.
in the earliest days of radio, the late 20s and the early 30s, announcers were very, very stuffy. They appeared to be stuffy because they were enunciating, and there was rarely was there warmth in the voice of an announcer in those days.
How would you know? You're too young.
Oh, we've heard so many of these shows. I love it. Everybody says I'm so young, but I grew up listening to the golden days of radio. But that group of announcers that were at CBS at the time you came in there, or that eventually came in along with you there, with Ralph Edwards and Harry Von Zell and so many, those people all, including yourself, became more than announcers. They became personalities.
Well, there was a reason for that. In those days, after every program, you gave your name.
Mm-hmm.
You are listening to Morning Melodies, your announcer, Andre Berouge. You are listening, you have listened to whatever, you know, your announcer, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. And you did that 5, 6, 7 times a day, 6, 7 days a week. As a result, your name went out over the air, over a national network, constantly, for years on end. And people got to know your name. Today, the announcer is anonymous. And he makes more money because he can do a lot of things. Commercials, as an example. You can spot me on a commercial like that, and I do a lot of them, but not nearly as many if my voice and style were not so distinctive.
Well, but by being Andre Berouge and having that personality, that style of your own, sometimes you may be on a commercial where you're not even identified. Probably most
you never identified,
but the listening audience recognizes that
many times.
If they don't know who it is, they recognize it as a familiar voice, and that in fact adds endorsement to the product. Because we hear on television many times, you hear a commercial with a voiceover, and you know it's a major motion picture star or somebody from a television.
Yes.
The name is not given or anything else, but the implication is there that they have that sort of thing. CBS, and now we're talking in the mid to late 30s here at the time that you were
when I started, it was early 30s.
Mm-hmm. What kind of network programs were coming out of CBS at that time? They're going coast to coast.
All the soap operas.
Mm-hmm.
All of them. Music for a Sunday Afternoon, the American Album of Familiar Music.
Frank Munn.
Manhattan Merry-Go-Round, Your Hit Parade, which I did for almost a quarter of a century. And my wife, B. Wayne, was on that show.
Yes, indeed.
I can't remember all of them.
Well, let's talk about the Hit Parade, Your Hit Parade, that series, which was, I think, for the entire radio run, was sponsored by Lucky Strike Cigarettes.
Yes.
And then once it got into television, I think it alternated with, it might have been Tony or Richard Hudnut or something like
well,
that.
Well, at the very end, possibly, but
most
of it was American Tobacco Company.
Mm-hmm.
And there again, it was a matter of just good fortune, because when they were auditioning announcers, and I was one of them, there were 75 announcers being auditioned for a particular program because it paid well.
Mm-hmm.
And I came in 73rd. However, came Saturday afternoon when they were doing the dress rehearsal and piping the show into the tycoon of the American Tobacco Company, Mr. George Washington Hill, he listened in his office at 111 Fifth Avenue. And when he heard the announcer, so nervous that you could hear the rattling of his script, that he finally called back and said, "Get that bleep out of there." Now, it's a Saturday afternoon, and where are the announcers? They called down to the announcer's room, and I was the only man there. And they said, "Who's this?" I said, "Berouge." He said, "Come on up to Studio One." I said, "What for? I'm on my lunch hour." They said, "If you want a permanent lunch hour, don't come up." So, of course, I ran upstairs, and here was this gigantic orchestra, 32 men. And, you know, for a studio orchestra, that was large. And the people from CBS and the agency people from Lord Thomas and Logan, which later became Foote, Cone and Belding, all descended upon me, urging me to give this a lot of punch. do it good and loud and strong and scream it out, you know. So I did. And I got the job, and that night I went on the air. And I yelled so loud you could have heard me at WBBM from New York without a mic. And I kept that job until the war, when I served in the Army and won it, as you know, World War II single-handed.
Absolutely.
Something that's acknowledged. And then when I came back...
In all the books.
When I came back, I started again. So I stayed with it, with the exception of the war years, what would be tantamount to almost a quarter of a century.
It's incredible.
As a matter of fact, mm-hmm. Your hit parade is still on the air.
You're doing it.
Yes.
You and B.
B and I have reproduced, or recreated, I should say, mm-hmm. Your hit parade by playing the original records that helped make these songs famous, but using the original sequence and of the Your Hit Parade as far as the surveys were concerned. In other words, if you heard a show of April 5th, 1951, mm-hmm. it would be the same program you heard in 1951, except using those records, as I say, which mm-hmm. helped make the songs famous. And the show is played all over the country. It plays in Chicago, but not on your station.
That's correct. It is in our Chicago area.
Yes. I'd name the station, but I don't want to hurt BBM because they need the money.
Well, that's true. Tell me about the original Hit Parade. You were on. How was that program built each week? You know, where did they start?
They started with the survey.
The survey, right.
And whatever songs were the top 10, mm-hmm. or sometimes were the top 15, sometimes the top 7, depending on what year you were in. But mostly it was the top 10 songs of the week, with numbers 1, 2, and 3 the most important. 3, 2, 1 were at the end of the show. The others were, depending on the programming, and depending on the type of song, usually a bright song would start. Mm-hmm. In between, there were Lucky Strike extras. We use them now just as Hit Parade extras. But the show was built on that basis. And I don't think that the performers really knew what position those songs were in. It was a deep, dark secret. I was the only one who knew outside of the mm-hmm. producers mm-hmm. because I had a script.
The performers didn't know until just as the show went on the air?
When the show went on the air, and when they had the dress rehearsal, actually, that was the first time they knew what position the songs were in, whether they were sixth or seventh or eighth or whatever.
Now, I can't imagine that the performers, with exception of maybe a mild interest, really cared what position they were on, but I was sure the producers did not want that information to get out to the public before this was broadcast, because that was part of the excitement of the show, trying to determine which was number one.
That and the fact that at one time the sponsor gave out his product to those people who could name the top 10 or the top 3 songs. He gave away a tin of cigarettes, and I wish I'd kept some of those because they're collector's
the
items.
Tins are collectible.
Yeah. But it was very exciting mm-hmm. to do that program. The performers were all wonderful. The singers were great. The orchestra was magnificent.
Well, you must have worked then with most all of, if you were there for that whole almost a 25-year span, you worked with
all of
with
them.
Frank Sinatra. Is that
yes.
where you met B. Wayne on
no.
the Hit Parade?
No, I met B. when she was singing in a chorus on the Kate Smith Show and the Fred Waring Show.
Mm-hmm.
B. was a chorus singer and a very good one. And when she was on the Fred Waring Show, I saw her. She was with a group called the V8, and a wonderful swing octet, probably the first real swing octet. You know Manhattan Transfer?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Well, this was the predecessor. And if you played both the V8 and you played Manhattan Transfer, you realize they're very similar as far as, mm-hmm. as type of mm-hmm. presentation is concerned. Well ahead of its time. In any case, referring to the position of songs, mm-hmm. they kept it a secret because it lent a misterioso to the presentation. people wondered what was happening on Saturday night. You know, what's number one? What's number three? Whatever the case may be. And the performers, Buddy Clark, Frank Sinatra, Barry Woods, B. Wayne, Dinah wasn't on the show.
Dinah Shore for a short time.
For a very short time, yes.
On there. And so was Georgia Gibbs, I think, before
yes.
she started Freda
Gibson.
Using the name Georgia yeah. Gibbs, right?
Sure.
Would you say Freda Gibson?
Freda Gibson, yeah.
Freda Gibson, yeah. And then later Joan Edwards.
Joan Edwards.
Fantastic amount of talented people on that hit parade. And yet the... With all the biggest names that were on there, and most of them were on there at a period of time when they had big names. It wasn't, you know, Frank Sinatra before he was known. He was big star Sinatra. He was on it as he was building up. He was at the
well. I think could
Paramount
tell you. Bea could tell you more about that since that's her milieu.
Well, we're going to talk with her in a little bit too.
But she was more familiar with the singers, although I never got familiar with singers because I was then married to her. But I didn't meet her there. I met her, as I say, on the chorus, in the chorus of the Fred Waring show, where I really didn't speak to her until we got to the Kate Smith show. And then I decided she was rather attractive and I should invite her out. Mm-hmm. And I did, but she wouldn't go out with me because the Kate Smith show, as did all shows in those days, had two presentations, one, say, at 8 o'clock for the East Coast mm-hmm. and one... at 11 o'clock for the West Coast. So by the time we got off the air, it was midnight. And she was too young. Her father would not let her go out with me at that time of the night. Mm-hmm. But one night, there was a big celebration for the opening of Benny Goodman at the Pennsylvania Hotel. And again, I asked if she would go out with me. And she prevailed upon her father to let her go because it was a special occasion. Mm-hmm. And we got to the Pennsylvania Hotel, and Bea and I sat in the audience. And Henny Youngman was the MC. And he was introducing all the celebrities. He finally got to me and he said, and here he is, the man who does the hit parade and the United States Steel Hour and blah, 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 blah. And went through the whole resume mm-hmm. and finally said, here he is, Andre Baruch and his lovely wife, B. Wayne. This was our first date. I could have killed him. Little did he know, or did I know,
and
eventually
her father
we would be married. So now, even after 50 years of marriage, he still says, see what I did for you, Andre? And he was right.
And you didn't say, take my wife, please.
No.
To
I kept her for 50 years, and I won't let her go.
I don't want to dwell so much on the hit parade, but I do want to know how much in advance of the broadcast did they start working on the show, the performers, the writers, and so forth?
The writers started, I would say, immediately after the show was
mm-hmm.
over.
Mm-hmm.
Show went on Saturday. Monday they would be at work. Mm-hmm. But they couldn't write until they knew what the survey mm-hmm. was doing. The singers, I believe, and B may correct me on this, the singers, I believe, started on Wednesday.
Mm-hmm. And by that time we knew... They knew which songs.
They knew which songs they were assigned.
Not necessarily the
right.
order.
Uh-huh. Then there was a rehearsal for announcers on either Thursday or Friday, mm-hmm. and that was piped into Mr. Hill, and he'd heard the commercials. Mm-hmm. You know, LS, MFT,
yes, mm-hmm.
Let's Stand, My Fanny's Tired, and things like that. We had all kinds of little cliches for those four letters.
Well, they had the That's Right, You Bet. Wasn't that a Lucky Strike
yeah.
thing?
There were a lot of slogans.
Lucky Strike Green goes to war, and well, all that. But those things, people really heard that. I mean, that sunk in. It was really part
sure.
of it. Now, you were doing commercials as well as introducing the
I did, as a matter of fact, at one point I did play-by-play for the Brooklyn Dodgers because mm-hmm. Red Barber, who was doing the play-by-play for the Dodgers, moved over to the Yankees.
Mm-hmm.
And they were looking for an announcer to do for a sportscaster, and somebody recommended me. And Walter O'Malley, who was the president of the Dodgers, the head of the Dodgers, called me in. He said, you know anything about baseball? And I said, sure. He said, well, what do you know about the Dodgers? And I started naming ball players from 30 years back that he had forgotten. And he said, oh, you really know them? I said, yeah. He said, how would you like to do play-by-play?
Mm-hmm.
I said, I'd love it. This was my dream. I loved sports, And the fact that I would be with the team that I, the team I had first seen, the first time I ever saw a baseball game when I came to this country from France, the first team were the Brooklyn Dodgers in Ebbets Field, and rooting for them through everything, thick and thin and ups and downs. And now I was going to be with them, and this was a great thrill.
Were you still on staff at CBS at
no.
this time?
I left the staff after 7 years, 7.5 years, went freelance.
You were off staff by the time you joined Hit Parade then?
No. I was on staff in 1935.
That's right, they called you up from downstairs. That's correct.
I was on staff in 35, and I stayed until about 37. And many of us left the staff because CBS then came up with an idea to start an artist bureau, or had an artist bureau, and would like to encompass all the announcers and take 20% of their income. And we deemed that inappropriate.
Mm-hmm.
And so most of the top announcers went freelance.
And then the announcers that replaced the staff announcers had to join this artist bureau.
Not necessarily. They realized they had made a mistake.
Oh. I think NBC had this similar kind of
a
thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
It was they wanted, it was like Louis B. Mayer making the movies and owning the theaters back in those days. Fascinating career. I'd like to talk some more about it and then ask your wife, B. Wayne, to join us. We'll take just a short break. I'm Chuck Shaden. We're visiting with one of the premier radio announcers of our time, Andre Baruch. We're talking with Andre Baruch, and his wife, B. Wayne, has been itching to get into this conversation from the first moment. So,
I'm
B.,
sure
we're glad
have.
That you're with us, too. And you were shaking your head when Andre said he got started in radio in Brooklyn, and then the next thing he was in the line at CBS auditioning as a pianist, you were saying, no, but you didn't want to talk. Now, tell us.
Well,
tell us the real facts.
Well, he knows the real facts.
The facts are very simple. I started in Brooklyn as a studio pianist in local radio stations.
Mm-hmm.
And I was still going to school at that time. And it wasn't until after 2 years of this that I had to make a determination as to whether I wanted to become an artist or, a painter or sculptor or a pianist. And that's when I applied to CBS for a job first as a studio pianist. And the rest is history. I don't know how much history it is, but it's there.
No, it's part of the history of radio. Now, what did you think when you were introduced by Henny Youngman as the lovely Mrs. Baruch?
I thought it was hilarious. I mean, I had no intentions of ever going out with him again. And we do see Henny now, and he is so proud of us. You know, see, I married you, and Andre keeps kidding him.
Well, but, that was a first date, and already you had made up your mind that you weren't going to go out with him again?
I was a very young girl, and I had a big career ahead of me in my own mind, and I wasn't going to let anything get in my way, including Andre.
Well, let's talk about your career for a little bit. You were singing in the chorus with Fred Waring and on the Kate Smith Show.
Well, I sang in trios, quartets. I was what they call now a group singer, backup singer. And it's a marvelous background. The experience is sensational. And there were a few of us that did all the shows. And we had this octet that Andre told you about that I'm terribly proud of. We were seven boys and one girl. I was the girl.
I hope so. If one of the boys, I'd be in trouble.
And the original V8 consisted of four boys who were the original Modern Airs and three other boys who were Al Rinker, who was with the Rhythm Boys with Whiteman, a boy by the name of Ken Lane, who played piano for Dean Martin.
Yes.
And another gentleman by the name of Johnny Smedberg, who has since passed away. But these were men that I really learned so much from. And I was the girl. And somebody said, Fred Waring ought to hear you. And we auditioned for him, and he liked the group right away. And he called us the V8 because at that time it was the Ford program. And we
that's where it came from.
That's where it came from.
I thought it was the tomato juice,
No.
That probably came a lot later.
And Andre was announcing the Ford program. And at that point, I also sang with Kay Thompson. Andre didn't mention that. Uh-huh. With Andre Castellanos. And we were 13 girls and three boys. And Kay Thompson is a tremendous talent. I mean, she came out to Hollywood here. Of course, this was all in New York. Mm-hmm. Excuse me. And she did a lot of motion picture arranging and producing and so forth. But anyway, I mean, she taught... excuse me. She taught Judy Garland, and to this day she works with Liza Minnelli.
Because I'm all right.
Excuse me. I'm getting emotional. And anyway, I sang with Kay Thompson and her chorus with Castellanos, which was also marvelous background, and with Fred Waring, and then I was asked to sing with the Kate Smith chorus. And this was all simultaneous. I mean, I was doing three, four, five shows a week, this rotten little kid.
All on the air.
And learning on the air. Mm-hmm. And Andre announced the Fred Waring show, and he announced the Kate Smith show. And during the Fred Waring show, as he told you, we were on that show for a little short of a year. And we never talked to each other. I mean, he was a big shot announcer. You know, he was the playboy of the Western world.
would you agree with that? You frown, Andre.
I don't know if the appellation is correct, but playboy of the Western world?
Yeah, but he was a busy, big star, sophisticated announcer, and I was a little kid. I keep saying that, but it's true. And one night on the Kate Smith show, Ted Strader was the leader of that chorus. And standing next to me, incidentally, singing high, I was singing low, was Dorothy Kirsten. I mean, some pretty good singers came out of these groups. She's, you know, from the Met.
Absolutely.
Great singer. Yeah. And I had a eight-bar solo one night, which was unusual because Kate was the star, and she had a female voice, and, you know, she wasn't going to let anything interfere. Mm-hmm. But we're going to have 12 bells now.
That's great.
And I sang this little solo, and at the end of the show, I had a phone call from a man by the name of Larry Clinton, whom I'd never heard of or didn't know, and he said... I heard your solo, and I heard about you. A lot of people in the music business, everybody knew me. Not well known to the world, but in the music business. He said, and I'm starting an orchestra, and I would like to have you sing with my band. I said, that's very nice. He said, I'm recording. This was like on a Friday night. He said, I'm recording next Tuesday at RCA Victor, and I'd like you to do a side. He never saw me. He never heard me, really.
Except
and here
for those,
he was booking me for a very important date. I mean, the band was young, and it was going to start out. And here he was hiring me to do a side. I thought he had a lot of courage and wasn't too smart. Anyway, I said, what was the song? And he told me it was a song called True Confession. That was my first record with him. And he said, I'll send you the copy. The sheet, the lead sheet, and you call me and tell me what key you'd sing it in, and I'll see you Tuesday at RCA. I said, okay. So I got the sheet music, and I got the key, and I met him at the studio, and we recorded the song. And it was very nice. The band was lovely, and he was kind. And he later said, look, we're going to start a band. Actually, what happened was RCA Victor backed him in a band. They had Tommy Dorsey. They had a lot of big bands. But they wanted to own a band of their own. And they brought this man who was a great arranger. He arranged for a lot of the big bands and composed some songs. And they wanted him to be the conductor. And he wasn't too anxious about it. Larry was an introverted man who wrote wonderful stuff. But he didn't like the idea of standing in front of the band. And it was hard for him, always. So I had to present the personality such as it was. Sitting in front of the band, writing letters to Andre. Actually, what happened after that, he was booked for several shows on RCA, here we go again, owned NBC. So we had a lot of sustaining shows on NBC. But the first one was the same night as the Kate Smith show I was doing on CBS. I had not left the Kate Smith chorus, and I didn't want to. Because now Andre and I were beginning to look at each other, and I figured if I left the Kate Smith show, I'd never see him again. So I told Larry, Larry said, we're going to start our show next week, blah, 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 and I didn't know what to do. I really didn't. And I went to Ted Strader, who was the conductor of the chorus, and I said, look, I have an opportunity, but it conflicts. We're on the same time. He said, look, I'll tell you what to do. He said, take the job, go with the band, and I'll put in a substitute. And very often in choruses, you would never know it, but there were substitutes. You know, if somebody had to do another date or something. Well, the punchline is that I never came back. The substitute was still there for years to come. But I joined the Larry Clinton Band, and then we did a lot of sustaining programs. And then we worked...
Were they almost all from the studios?
RCA.
Mm-hmm. All studio, rather than remote. You were not...
Well, then we went on the remote. We opened a Glen Island Casino. That was the first. You see, they planned this very carefully. We went on the Glen Island Casino from May until September. Whole summer, 7 nights a week. And as a sidebar, we opened, let's say, May 16th, which was true, 1938. Mm-hmm. We were married, Andre and I, May 1st, 1938. We went off on a honeymoon. I came back and worked 7 nights a week from 7 to 2 at the Glen Island Casino, and Andre sat there, waited for me every night.
I can understand that. Yeah. I can see why you would wait for her every night. She's a lovely lady.
You know, on the subject of remotes that B is, of which B is speaking, in the days that we were on staff, we had to do remotes. And the bands we were introducing, the leaders of which, were originally sidemen in the house band at CBS. The Dorseys.
Artie Shaw.
Artie Shaw, Benny Goodman. They all played in the
Bunny Berrigan.
Yeah, they were all in the band at CBS. So when they became band leaders, we didn't think too much about it. Figured, well, all right, so he's a band leader. Little did we realize that these men would become the big names of the big bands. And today, revered by everyone, you know, they're now the history of music.
Yeah, you know, everybody says, how does it feel? People to me say, how does it feel to have been part of history? And I said, if I knew it was history, we'd have paid more attention.
Well, but you see, that's not what makes history, that you pay attention, as you say. I know what you're saying. But what makes history is that you do the job you're supposed to do, and you do it with care and concern, and you do it to the best, and love, yes, and you do it to the best of your ability. And that's what makes the history, because if you didn't care, there's hundreds of bands that started up in that period of time that we never, ever heard of again. You know, they'd do this and do that.
Well, when we were at Glen Island Casino, that's when we started doing remotes, and we were on every night, all over the country. Larry Clinton, B. Wayne doing the vocals. And what happened was, then we went on the road. After this September, after we closed at the casino, the band was famous all throughout the country because of the remotes.
Yes.
And then we were booked in college dates. Then we went, and these were funny, we went in the bus most of the time. We went from Yale to the University of Kentucky back to Baltimore. I mean, they really ran us ragged. This was another experience, these one-nighters doing the colleges. And everybody expect us to come out being rested and gorgeous and chic, you know. And we're dragging. And we did the colleges, and then we did theaters. We started to do a lot of theaters. And my name, fortunately for me, I had a couple of hit records, for which I got very little money. I don't know if you ever heard this. But the singers with bands in those days got a salary, no matter what you did.
They got paid by the band leader or the owner of the band?
By the band leader or whoever was behind them, but we weren't always sure of that. But we got paid. Let's say when we were at Glen Island Casino, I got $50 a week. Mm-hmm. And every musician got $50 a week. But when we did recordings, like My Reverie and Deep Purple and Martha and all those, they paid me an extra $30 a session. Four sides was a session. And so when I did Deep Purple, which sold millions and everybody made a fortune on, all I got was that $30 with three other sides.
Excuse me for interrupting, but I think that Chuck should know, and the audience at BBM should know, that you are an important part of a new organization called the Society of Singers. And the reason for the establishment of what is truly a fine organization, with most of the top singers of the country as members. Frank Sinatra's
he's chairman of the board.
Ginny Mancini, Henry Mancini's wife, is the president. B is the treasurer, of course. But B, I think you are better equipped than I am to speak about it.
All of us from that era, I mean, Helen O'Connell
yes.
is one of us. Mm-hmm. Helen Forrest. You just name them all. And we made absolutely no money. And what we're hoping for with the Society of Singers, because so many of us have fallen between the cracks. I mean, I didn't. I married well.
That's what they'd like you to believe.
It was no mm-hmm. secret that Bob yeah. Eboli and Ray Eboli both died
indigent.
Indigent.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact, Bob was in a charity ward, and it was Sinatra who got him into a decent room mm-hmm. for the mm-hmm. last days. And they are still selling their records, and somebody is making a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're fighting. We have a great group. I mean, really.
And the object of this organization is to...
What we hope to do mm-hmm. eventually is to build a home, like the Motion Picture Academy has a home.
Mm-hmm.
As I say, singers are the most unrewarded people. And we don't want just the old singers like me, because we're going to fall off eventually. Mm-hmm. But the younger singers have to be in there to help.
Does this still apply to singers on recording today?
Well, of course, the singers today are the rock singers who are making millions.
See, today and I want to stay on this for a second, but today you don't have a band with a singer performing. Today the singer is the star. Right. I mean, now the rock musicians, they're the whole thing.
But they fall mm-hmm. apart, too. Let's face it.
Yeah,
there are rock singers who have flitted away all their money.
Who have not only have they flitted away their money, but the record companies mm-hmm. have taken advantage of them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are
mm-hmm.
lawsuits right and left, and the singers keep losing.
There is a Chicago branch, incidentally.
Of the Society of Singers.
Of the Society of Singers, run by a fellow named Randy Van Horn.
Oh,
a very
sure,
talented
yeah.
man.
This is a new branch. It just started a couple of weeks or months ago.
You might want to talk to him at some point.
That's a good idea. Is this open to... The membership is open only to singers?
No.
Open to anybody?
Everybody loves singers.
Yes.
I mean, in everyone's life, there was a song or a singer that made him fall in love.
You're so right.
Or made him whatever. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a romanticism to this.
Why don't you give the slogan, which I think is so beautiful.
It's time. You hit me cold.
I always do.
Excuse me. It'll come to me. It's time.
Wait, I'll get your shirt.
Oh, my heavens. Andre, you shouldn't do that to me.
I wanted to say that
it's important that everybody mm-hmm. can join. Mm-hmm. What I started to say is everybody loves singers, so they want to help singers. And we have a lot of the big corporations going to fall in and help us. And next year, in mm-hmm. April, this is our big, big event. We're very excited about it. We're going to honor Ella Fitzgerald.
Oh.
And this mm-hmm. is the first time she has been honored. We're going to give out an award, which will be called the Ella. And it'll be an annual thing every year so that the Society of Singers will go on. Please excuse me, of course. It's time the rare bird called a singer had some tender, loving care.
Oh, that's nice. That's nice.
And it stopped me. I'm sorry.
I don't think that I'm sure that the fans, the people who enjoyed the bands and the songs and the singers, were really aware of what you're saying about the fact that, you know, you get $30 for four sides, and it didn't make any difference how big a hit the record was, or where it went, or what it finally did. Frank Sinatra recorded a song as a vocalist.
Exactly.
Well, that's one thing. But when he sang with
Tommy Dorsey
or Harry James, may not have been the same kind of a situation.
Actually, the thing that I wanted to bring out before mm-hmm. is the fact that after I left the band, I was only with them for a year and a half. Everybody thinks it was much longer. I went out on the road by myself.
Mm-hmm.
And because of the records with the band, I was able to command a good salary. So I can't knock my time with the band, you know. And, of course, the experience mm-hmm. was sensational. Mm-hmm. And I had a good time. It was hard work. And I was lonely for Andre. But it was a good background for me.
Well, when you left the band, and when you left Larry Clinton after all the studio shows and then the tough job of being on the bus and going one-nighters. By the way, I always have the impression that buses of band musicians and singers must have been passing each other on the highways because so many in that period of time,
of course,
so many of them were traveling from one venue to the next. It was just constant on that sort of thing.
And we played with other bands, of course. Mm-hmm. I remember when we were one of the universities. I think it was Pennsylvania one time. They always had two bands.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
mm-hmm.
these kids really had great dancers, and we would be on one side, and Duke Ellington would be on another. I mean, we would spell each other.
Mm-hmm.
We would stop playing and run over to listen to Duke, and or Tommy or Benny or Chick Webb, and that's the way it was, you know. And we learned a lot. God, we learned a lot. Of course, the riding in the buses was pretty gruesome, and we were very lucky. Once in a while, we got on a train.
That was unusual.
Yeah.
Unusual.
And we had, as I say, we had to come in. We'd dress in the boys' mm-hmm. gyms in the colleges.
Uh-huh.
Most of them were men's colleges. Princeton, at that mm-hmm. time, they mm-hmm. were all mm-hmm. men. And we'd go into the locker rooms, you know, and get dressed and expect to come out looking good.
And you were saying before that they expect you after a grueling, probably all-night run on the bus, they expected you to come in and fresh. And you did.
Yeah.
No matter how you felt, whatever, you just, you know.
Yeah. And of course, they made these ridiculous mm-hmm. runs. I'm not kidding when I say we go from Syracuse to Alabama and then back east. I think they were punishing us, the agents.
Somebody wasn't paying attention to the booking.
We used to sing on the road for MCA, doing 20 shows a day, you know.
But you probably wouldn't trade that period of time either for anything, would you?
I was lucky. It was as I say, Andre was there, home, waiting.
Yeah, yeah. Well, when you left the band then, is that about the time when you joined the... Now, that was before you joined the Hit Parade. No?
Right. Yeah. I went out to do theaters,
mm-hmm.
now as a feature, you know, not with the band, but on my own. Incidentally, somebody just sent me a picture. I have to tell you about this. I played the Paramount Theater in New York, and mm-hmm. Harry James Benn. And this is the weirdest feeling to see me right behind Harry James. I'm singing and he's playing. And of course, I never worked with the band mm-hmm. except in the theater.
Yeah. Well, he was a backup for you at that occasion.
They always had a band mm-hmm. and a singer, mm-hmm. a star, mm-hmm. let's say, and maybe a comic. They used to have a comic too.
Well, there was a lot of value to that kind of work too. I mean, performing must have been 3, 4, maybe sometimes 5. Shows a day in the theaters, yeah.
And we used to open at the Paramount.
Mm-hmm.
At first show was 11 o'clock. And it cost 25 cents to get in. I'm talking about the New York Paramount.
Mm-hmm.
For these great shows. And it cost 25 cents to get in. And the kids would come. And they'd sit in the first 20 rows, maybe. And stay there all day. And we used to come out on the stage and bring them sandwiches. I mean, we felt sorry for them. They were there because they were such fans. And to me, the big mm-hmm. thrill, and I guess it's in Chicago. Of course, I played the Oriental in Chicago.
Oh, yes.
I played the Chicago mm-hmm. Theater. But the big thrill was watching these bands come up
from
the elevator, out of the pit.
Yeah.
I think that was just so sensational, playing the theme, you know.
As a spectator in the theater, the Chicago or the Oriental, the band would come up from the pit like that. The movie would end... And the newsreel would go on, or previews or something. And then, and whenever that, the short subject would be just about ending, some of the stage lights would go on, the lights on the curtain, the band would start playing live, and it would lift
play the
up.
Theme song.
Yeah, start playing the theme, would come up. Goosebumps time.
Me too.
I mean,
I've
it was terrific.
Well,
I'm happy to know that you got them too. I mean, that was so dramatic. That was so showbiz.
Oh,
it was wonderful.
I agree.
It was a marvelous thing. And that, as you say, for a quarter. I mean, that's the...
Well, it was 35 cents after one.
Well, she had to go out and deliver a few more
and
papers.
And I was the voice on the newsreels.
That's right.
I did Pathé News for 20 years.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah.
And then after I did theaters for a year and nightclubs, I did mm-hmm. a lot of clubs. And I opened the Rio Bamba in New York after Frank Sinatra. And that was a very important engagement for me. And then I got the call. I was in Baltimore, as a matter of fact. And I got a call from my agent saying they want you on the Hit Parade. And I said, great, I'll be able to see my husband, you know, if only at rehearsal. And that's when I joined the Hit Parade, shortly after that. It was 39.
Did you, Andre, did you have anything to do with getting B on the Hit Parade?
No, I didn't know she even had been called.
I resent that. Everybody says
no,
that.
It's I don't know anything about it.
You're not question. Alone. But everybody says, you know, your husband got you in. No.
You don't no, I didn't say he got you in. I asked if no. he... I mean, you know, it's not bad to have an agent saying, why don't you think about this person? Why don't you think about B. Wayne? You know, I mean,
B. didn't have an agent, as a matter of fact, including me. One thing in our professional lives were not mixed up with our normal everyday life. We just... She didn't have an agent to start with. Mm-hmm. I did. But I had nothing to do with her appearance on the hit parade. She was called by the advertising agency.
Mm-hmm.
And the first thing I knew was she said, I just got a job on your hit parade. I said, you're kidding. I have to be with you on Saturday night as well.
That was great. It was wonderful.
It was real fun.
Now, how long a time were you on the hit parade, Bea?
I was on from 39 to 41. Then Joan Edwards came on for a while. And she went off. And I came back on. And it was on until 44.
B also did a program called Your All-Time Hit Parade.
Did you know about that?
I knew that show. That was
the best tunes of all come from Carnegie Hall.
yeah.
That was the slogan.
That was these were more or less the standards, weren't
standards.
They? Yeah.
That was a thrill too because it was in Carnegie Hall. Mm-hmm. It was the first radio show I'd ever been there, and Mark Warner, who conducted the orchestra on your hit parade during the period I was on, conducted that orchestra, and he was an inspiration. He was a marvelous man, a marvelous conductor, and he just made you want to sing. And he had this orchestra, must have been 40 pieces, and it was exciting.
Now that was sponsored also by Lucky Strike,
right? Mm-hmm. And Andre was overseas during that period. He never heard that, did you?
No, I didn't hear that, Joe.
Was Del Sharbert, was he in there while you were overseas?
I was overseas, yes.
But when Del was on?
Del and Kenny Delmar.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And Basil
Rysdale, the greatest voice in show business.
Boy, he really did have a deep voice.
He made me sound like a soprano.
That's almost impossible to do.
No, it isn't. Yeah. As a matter of fact, the staff at CBS had some really deep voices. When you consider David Ross, Harry Von Zell, Del Sharbert, all rich, deep voices. Frank Gallup, rich, deep voice.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
Andre doesn't think he has a deep voice.
I don't think so. I was more on the light baritone level. And people like Ralph Edwards came in, and he, too, was lighter.
So he's a lot lighter than those names you mentioned, of course.
And some of the other men became lighter announcers. There was more inflection in our voices. We played around a lot with the voice, more so than the standard announcer who had his hand behind his ear to hear what he could... The reason for the hand behind the ear, incidentally, was not only so you could hear yourself when there was nobody in back of you, but it gave you a sense of importance. No one else in the whole studio put his hand behind his ear except the announcer. Some of the singers did.
I did on the hit parade because I had this big orchestra behind me and I wanted to hear me.
Which is the reason the announcers did it.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted to hear themselves. You could hold your tie in and get the same result, of course.
but it's no fun pulling the tie.
Hold your tie, you know.
Well, we're going to put our hand, we're going to cup our ear a little bit and take a short break and maybe continue our conversation if you've got a few more minutes.
We've got 40 more years to go.
We've just started. So stick around. We're talking to B. Wayne and Andre Baruch. Don't touch that dial. We're having a delightful visit with Andre Baruch and his wife, B. Wayne, or B. Wayne and her husband, Andre Baruch.
Yes, I think you better give her top
give her
billing
some top billing.
Otherwise, I'm in trouble.
Ladies first. Beauty before the beast or something.
Obviously.
And it's a fascinating career that you two have had individually and together as well.
Well, you've been around as long as we are, you know, that everything has happened.
Well, we're still working very hard.
I know you are. You're
very hard.
You're still you're still, of course, producing your Hit Parade broadcast, and these are programs. They're hour long shows syndicated all across the country.
We're very proud of them. Andre writes them.
They're excellent.
And
excellent programs. I've heard.
We get wonderful
many
mail,
of them.
And the interesting thing about the mail on that show is the fact that we get much of it from young people who write. I'm in my 20s. I feel like I missed something when I wasn't there for that music, and now I'm learning all about it, and I love it. A lot of letters from young people who who feel that they lost something by not living in that time.
That's the beauty of it. It's not, it's nostalgia for some people, but it's first exposure for others.
Exactly.
And I don't know, I've said this so many times, it's the quality of the material that is able to keep it going, because if the stuff wasn't any good in the first place, nobody would want to hear it.
Well, there were a lot of rotten songs in those
days,
too.
Well, yeah, but, you know, but what was on the hit parade mostly wasn't rotten. And if it was, might have been a one-shot novelty, but it was so much fun to hear those, you know, Shoo Shoo Baby and Three Little Fishies. But the one thing I have to tell you both about your show, your hit parade, and Andre, if you're writing it primarily, then this is really directed at you. It's so much more than just saying, and now here's this song by so-and-so. You got a little background, a little comment, and of course with you're both the backgrounds that you have, you know so many of those people,
right,
and you know so much about the music. That's what makes it interesting.
Well,
the fact that you add that extra bit of information, that's what people want.
We're proud of the fact that we were there. Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay? Sure, yeah.
I mean, there are a lot of young cats around that are talking, well, I heard that Tommy Dorsey did so-and-so, or I read that Harry James. We were there when they did it.
Mm-hmm.
And we were in the room. And nobody can ever take that away from us.
You know, they describe nostalgia as the good old days, when you were neither good nor old, and you didn't know what you were doing anyhow. But the good old days, as I recall them, were really fun. There's not as much fun in radio and TV today as there was then. Today everything is so high-tech that it's cut and dried. Today I go into a studio to do commercials. I don't know the people I'm working with.
Mm-hmm.
I'm referring to the producers, to the engineers, and even some of the young actors I work with. And today you have people who are much younger, certainly younger than I am, and many funny things happen because of that. I recall a story of Lloyd Nolan coming into a studio where a motion picture director who was about 26 or 27 years old and was sitting in a jogging suit, you know, had his feet up on the desk, and was interviewing this great star for a job in a motion picture. And there he was with his feet up on the desk and his shoes off and his smelly socks. And Lloyd sat down with a shirt and tie and very distinguished. And the director, young director, said to Lloyd Nolan, what have you done? And Lloyd said, I haven't done anything. It smelled this way when I came in. And he walked right out of the studio. Sheldon Leonard, one of the fine actors, when interviewed recently by a young director who said, what have you done? Sheldon looked him in the eye and said, you first.
Yeah.
Let me hear your credential before you ask me about mine. And the same is true today, although I don't rile at a young director. If he says what he tells me what he wants, I do what he says.
Mm-hmm.
That's fine with me. But sometimes I question their ability because of their lack of experience as to what the public wants or what consummates or what constitutes a sale. You know, today is so much gimmickry, you don't know what the hell's being sold.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Ray Singer, one of the great radio writers.
Yes, we know Ray.
Said to us that I asked him, why is the writing for television generally so bad compared to the writing for radio, which was generally so good? And he thought just one second, and he said, I'll tell you, he says, there's no talent out there today. Nobody takes the time to develop the talent to write that stuff. They don't have, they're young people who don't take the time to develop this thing, and all of a sudden they're in charge of the creative, they're in charge of development of comedy for the network or something like that.
I think Ray has hit it on the head. Of course, he knows. He's written a lot of big shows.
Certainly,
but of course, in those days, when you're talking about writing for radio, you're listening to the radio was your eyes and your ears, so you had to write better.
Bea, did you ever sing? Were you ever a featured singer on a comedy or a variety show as an individual?
I sang, after I did the hit parade. When we last left the hit parade. I was on a show called The Alan Young Show. Uh-huh. Alan Young was a comic they brought down from Canada during that period. And we did the show in New York, and then he came out to Hollywood to do Mr. Ed, and they continued it out here. But I did a lot of shows. I did, many, many shows. And during the war, of course, I performed in all the army camps and all the naval bases and the hospitals and so forth. Well, this is while Andre was away. As a matter of fact, and this is a true story, when Glenn Miller went overseas, and we were good friends, he came to me and he said, you know, we have this orchestra, which to me was the greatest band that ever was.
Mm-hmm. The Army Air Force Band.
Army Air Force
Miller's
Band.
Band, yes,
with all the great musicians. I mean, they were all there. And he said, we're going to take a girl singer with us. And I said, I think you should do it. I'd love to have you sing with the band. I said, great, because Andre's overseas. And I said, wonderful, I'll have the opportunity. I'll see him, you know. Mm-hmm. Nobody else is in the world. And he said, great. He said, I'll make arrangements. You'll have to join the WAC. And I said, what? He said, well, you have to be a member of the service. The WAC, as you probably know, is the Women's Army Corps. Mm-hmm. And you're in the military. So I said, gee, I don't know if I can do that, but I'll find out. And I wrote a letter to Andre, and I said, guess what? I'm going to join the WAC, and I'm going to come over with Glenn Miller, and we'll be able to be together. And he wrote back, and he said, you crazy? You know, don't do that.
He said, not one person is being shot at without you doing it.
I don't want to think of you, home, and our lovely apartment in New York. So I told Glenn, forget it. And I often think that I might have been with him on that trip, that fateful trip.
Mm, and how?
Yeah.
Well, Andre, when you were in the service, were you doing anything at all related to your civilian career, or were you
yes.
a serviceman? I mean, a fighter.
No, we were in the original invasion of Africa on November 8, 1942, and landed on the west coast of Africa in a town called Port Leote.
Mm-hmm.
And after 4 days of conflict, we subdued whatever military forces were there. And we just sat around. We went down to Casablanca, and I brought my company down there. And as we were sitting there doing nothing, one of my officers said to me, Andre, why don't we put up a radio station? I said, you sound like Mickey Rooney. Let's put on a show. I said, where do we get the equipment? He said, I'll steal it. I said, well, maybe. Excuse me. So he said, you have to get permission. I said, from whom? He said, General Patton. I said, you go. He said, no, you have to go. You're the commander of the unit. So with great trepidation, I went to see the commanding officer, the general, and I explained to his aide what I was there for. And finally, he said, the general will come out. And out he came with his highly polished boots and his pearl-handled revolvers and looked at me straight in the eye and said, what the bleep do you want? And scared the devil out of me, you know. And I explained that we wanted to put up a radio station, the purpose of which was to not only entertain the troops, but possibly be of of some information service to the troops themselves, or possibly to the army, by broadcasting information that it needed as to where units were, by playing certain records or telling certain stories or whatever. And he agreed, and he signed a release. And so we put up this little 250-watt station in Casablanca. My exec officer stole something from the French, and he stole something from someplace else. And before we knew, we had a transmitter and a couple of mics, and away we went. And we played some records, none of which were B. Wayne records. Although I did, there was a captain who had some B. Wayne records, and I was advised that he had them. Mm-hmm. And I went over to see him. When I got to his billet, he had B's pictures plastered all over the walls. And I walked in, I said, hey, Captain, I see you're a B. Wayne fan. He said, yeah, isn't he beautiful? And he started to tell me what he'd like to do to B. Wayne. And I was afraid to say I'm her husband, but I said, I understand you have some B. Wayne records. And we just started a little radio station here, and he said, you want to borrow some records, right? I said, well, he said, get the hell out of here. And he took out his .45 and pointed it at me. And I thought he was going to shoot my tail off, so I got out of there. When I came back to my unit, they said, did you get the records? I said, no. I didn't want to get killed. That was part of our comeback.
Now, that's a real fan. That's
oh,
a fan.
He
protect
fan.
His records. Huh?
But we started the Armed Forces Radio Service in Africa, put up a station in Casablanca, in Oran, Algiers, Tunis, Constantine, Sicily, southern France. We just went up the line. So we were the actual predecessors of the current Armed Forces Television and Radio Service.
This was early enough. You say it was early 42?
This was late 42. Late 42.
See, AFRS, Armed Forces Radio Service, didn't become that until around that time. As you say, you were starting it there because it was the Office of War Information, OWI,
they called themselves the beginning. American Expeditionary Stations.
We were AES.
That was
AES.
And Tom Lewis, who headed the Armed Forces Radio Service, sent a lieutenant over. He had heard that the radio station was started in Africa. And this lieutenant came over and said, "What are you fellas doing here?" I said, "We're putting on radio programs. What are you doing here?" And he said, "Well, Colonel Lewis is head of the Armed Forces Radio Service." I said, "Good old Tom. Used to be with Young and Rubicam and a good friend of ours." I said, "Give him my best regards." He said, "Well, we're taking over your radio station." I said, "You got to be kidding, buddy." I said, "Get out of here." And so I kicked him out. And it wasn't until I got an official letter from Tom Lewis saying, "Look, Andre, you have to understand we're doing so and so and so and so, and we can be of help. We can send you records. We can send you information. We can send over men to help you man these stations." And, of course, I realized that it would be good.
And then after Casablanca, you built a few more, right?
Yes, as I said, we put up stations all through Africa and Italy and Sicily. And it became the basis for what is today the Armed Forces Radio and Television Service, or Television and Radio Service, and what wonderful things they are doing.
Oh, yeah. Now, is your current show being heard on Armed Forces Radio?
No.
That I'm sure there must be
too many
a lot of young soldiers might welcome a break.
I agree.
In the heavy metal.
They might, but
so far it hasn't.
So far they haven't called us and said they wanted the show. It's available to them, of course.
You've had both of you have had a really fascinating career, and Andre, you mentioned earlier in our conversation that you made a few mistakes, a few flubs on the air, or something like that. Can you think of something that you can tell us that might have been really disastrous at the time, but as you look back it was just part of it all?
Well, let's see. There was a program on called Exploring the Unknown. And it was a science fiction program, and I was the announcer. The opening announcement was in an echo chamber. Today, of course, in order to affect an echo, all you have to do is push a button, and electronically you get the echo. In those days, they couldn't do that. What they did was to take another microphone and put it in the men's room so that there would be the reverberation of the tiles. Of course, sometimes we got some extraneous sounds, which we couldn't help. In any case, they put this mic in the men's room, and I would come on and say, and make that opening announcement. On this particular night, I opened with, "And now, Exploring the Unknown, brought to you by Revere, makers of quality products in copper, brass, aluminum, and steel."
That was you, huh?
Then once, I recall I was, I can't remember the soap opera, but I was announcing the show. And 5 minutes before airtime, the lead got sick and just couldn't go on. And the director was frantic. And he said, "Andre, you'll have to play the part of the lead." I said, "I don't even know what's in the script. I wasn't here for rehearsal." He said, "No, you'll just have to do it cold. Just wing it." I said, "All right." Well, I was playing the part of a surgeon in the midst of the show. Now, you have to picture this. It's a radio show, but we are in an operating room, and I am playing the part of the surgeon and performing this very delicate brain operation. In the midst of it, finally I turn to the nurse and say, "Nurse, hand me the hypodermic needle." There was silence for a moment, and the whole cast broke up. And I started laughing, and I couldn't stop.
That's terrible, isn't it, though, not to be able to stop laughing?
You can't.
I mean, and if the audience missed what you said, they don't know where you're at, but it's so hard to compose yourself.
Can you recall
yourself.
Any of the others?
Well, there are so many of them. No, you can't put them on the air. Not on this show.
They don't have to do a cavalcade of bloops. I found a note someplace that told me that at one point you were known on the air, very short time, as Two-Gun Andre Baruch.
No, Two-Gun Andy.
Two-Gun Andy.
Yes.
This was on what show?
This was on the Bobby Benson show. Bobby Benson, who was played by a fellow named Billy Hallop, a mean little kid. He was really mean.
You mean in real life?
In real life, yeah.
He was one of the dead end kids, or the East Side kids.
Dead end kids, and rightfully so. I mean, he found his own level. I shouldn't speak that way about someone who was no longer with us. He was a very good actor, but he was a mean little kid. Anyhow, at one point, I became Two-Gun Andy, and I spoke with a pseudo Texas accent, and I rode the range. And I shot up a lot of big guys. In any case, Two-Gun Andy became very popular. But that's in a distant past. That's in the early 30s.
You know what I like about you? You've done your homework.
Thank you.
I think that's wonderful.
Thank you.
I mean, you know things. You don't just come in and say, well, you know, how did you start? Blah, blah, blah.
Well, I think that I don't want to make a big fuss about this, but I think you deserve to have me do a little homework.
Well,
because
that's
you've
true,
done
but,
so much
but I'm so impressed
work,
that
and we're glad
done.
To.
But you're singular in that a lot of interviewers have not done their homework or don't know anything about the people they interview, except that maybe these are people we should know something about. That's no way to start an interview. But here you have notes and you know
it's
what you're talking
impressive.
About.
Thank you very much. You have, Andre, you worked on one of the, aside from the hit parade, you worked on one of the great radio mystery shows of all time. The Shadow.
Yes.
And were you selling blue coal for them?
Selling blue coal. The Shadow was a fellow named Brett Morrison, fine actor. And who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men.
How long did you do The Shadow?
A few years. I followed Ken Roberts, I think. Well, he followed me, I'm not sure.
Yeah, there's such
he was a, good friend,
great
announcer.
Yeah. Well, so are you. And B, you are a wonderful person and
I played on
scene.
The Shadow once.
Did you?
Yes.
They gave me a role.
No kidding.
Just, you know, one of the...
You weren't the lovely Margot Lane.
No. I mean, I was just one time. They needed a singer.
Oh.
Part of the plot had to do with a song that meant something to somebody, and that was the clue to the mystery, so I did it.
Did you do much acting, B, on radio?
Well, that kind,
some, yes.
A little bit of that?
Right.
And Andre, did you do more than Two-Gun Andy?
Oh, yes. We were pressed into service frequently. As a matter of fact, I did Heartbeat Theater recently.
That's a Salvation Army program out here in the West
years.
Coast. Yeah,
but I acted on it. I didn't announce it.
What did you play, Colonel somebody?
I can't remember his name. Not Colonel. I was a major in the Salvation Army.
He got demoted.
Yeah, I got demoted.
You got busted.
Well, major was my rank in the Army, so it worked out. There was one thing I forgot to mention, Chuck. And that was the fact that at CBS, in the early days, in the 7 o'clock slot, all the top singers started. Bing Crosby, the street singer.
Arthur Tracy.
Kate Smith.
Morton Downey.
Morton Downey. All started at 7 o'clock. I recall Bing Crosby, I was his first announcer. And he was so bad, his voice was so bad, he had to quit. And I turned to Harry Von Zell and I said, hey, get this bum off my shoulders. I'll take two of your shows if you'll take one of mine. Just take him.
He was a great judge of talent.
I really knew talent. In any case, Harry said, all right. So he took the show. And, of course, Bing was on for about a month. And he turned commercial. He went to the Cremo program, Cremo Cigars. And so he got paid. And I could have killed myself. Later on, Bing and I became very good friends. As a matter of fact, we spoke with Bing just a couple of months before he passed away. He called us. We were in Florida, and he was in Miami Beach, and we were in Palm Beach, and he called us and said, he wanted to talk to us and say hello, you know, would tell us what he was doing.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a good friend. I used to play golf with Bing and Bob, both very good golfers, in the East when they were there.
You know, that's the wonderful thing about this business. Through the years, we have gained so many wonderful friends. And sometimes you don't see them for a very long time. I mean, I worked with somebody, mm-hmm. and I didn't see them for a couple of years. And then we see each other, and we're long-lost relatives. There's a fraternity in show business that's really quite lovely. And, of course, we lived in the East all our lives. Mm-hmm. And we moved out here to Hollywood, California, Beverly Hills, Los Angeles, in 1980. And a lot of our friends were here, had been here all mm-hmm. through the years. And we just picked up with them like we were never apart. And if you turn around, you'll see that beautiful golden balloon, hot air balloon.
Oh,
that,
yes.
That, you know, we just celebrated our 50th wedding anniversary.
Isn't that beautiful?
Danny uh-huh. Thomas and Rosemary, his wife, uh-huh. sent us that. And I think it's so lovely, you know.
We had a party that was given to us by our children.
Mm-hmm.
And 70 people showed up. The mm-hmm. show was 2 hours long.
Everybody
came in and did something.
Oh, how marvelous.
Yeah.
Oh, what
marvelous.
A, yeah. I had the best time I've ever had at a party. It was wonderful.
Well, that's great. Yeah. You didn't have to perform? You just enjoyed it?
Oh, we performed.
I bet you did.
Yeah.
I couldn't stop you too, huh?
The show. We thought we'd do a little shtick at the beginning. And then everybody else got up,
mm-hmm.
including Ralph Edwards and Gene Barry and Danny Thomas, and I don't know, everybody got up.
Oh, that's so nice. That's so nice.
It was nice.
Now, you did have an opportunity to work closely together with a kind of a talk show. It started in New York and went to Florida.
To the talk show,
mm-hmm.
B and I were the first husband and wife disc jockey team in New York. We were known as Mr. and Mrs. Music on WMCA mm-hmm. in New York. Mm-hmm. Then later we were on the ABC network, then the NBC network, doing a half disc jockey and half talk show. On ABC, we did talk.
But mm-hmm. the other thing we did that was unusual, all these stations had live musicians on staff mm-hmm. during that period, and they were available to mm-hmm. play. And so I did a lot of live singing. I had a trio, wonderful trios, piano, bass, and guitar. And I did live singing within the 2-, 3-, 4-hour disc jockey shows.
Mm-hmm.
So that was different, you know. And Andre and I both did commercials. And we did play records, but we got away from playing records when we went to Florida. Our kids had grown up and mm-hmm. been in college and so forth, and we didn't need this big house anymore. And we decided, Andre came down to Florida on some business, and he said, what are we doing here in the snow, you know?
a lot of Easterners ask that question, yeah.
So we moved down to Palm Beach, mm-hmm. where we had a radio show, a disc jockey show. And we started out playing records, but it didn't last long because many people called us and said, we don't want to hear the music, we want to talk to you. Mm-hmm. We want to know about you. We want to hear stories about you.
They want to hear stories about the business, too.
Yeah, well, that's
But eventually it was politicized in that we spoke about everything, mm-hmm. politics.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever we got to politics, B would point to me. when I got to show business, I would point to her.
And we did interviews, like uh-huh. you're doing. Uh-huh. Everybody came to Palm Beach eventually, mm-hmm. authors, politicians, performers, and they all came on our show. So we really had a very popular show for 8.5 years. We did 4 hours a day.
4 hours a day of talk mm-hmm. is a lot of talk.
Five days a week.
Meeting a lot of interesting people, too.
Yes. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then our kids settled out here mm-hmm. in Los Angeles. And we began to get tired, you know. It was a hard show. Mm-hmm. It was fun and it was wonderful, but it required a great deal of research. We used to have to go out every night to all these marvelous Palm Beach parties, my dear.
Tough. That's
what a
tough.
Way to suffer.
And yeah. to all the openings. They had a lot of great stuff down uh-huh. there. And we decided that we would mm-hmm. not renew our contract, and they were devastated. They really were, because we had a big audience. And we moved out here, mm-hmm. and here we are. And we moved out here in 1980, and we started the Hit Parade syndicated show.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you've been doing that since 80?
Yes.
Yeah. And we're doing... Andre does a lot of commercials, and I do a lot of personal appearances.
Mm-hmm. You work together in person
sometimes.
Places?
We have an act.
We have an act.
Have you?
We've
yeah.
been on the road with it.
Gee, we'd love to get you to Chicago sometime.
It's really cute.
It'd be terrific,
say.
Yeah.
We have a lot of special material.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm working with the Society of Singers, hoping that we can get somewhere with that.
Well, and I'm working with the Pacific Pioneer Broadcasters.
A wonderful group, incidentally.
Oh, yes. What a great group.
Well, I thank you both for spending this time, letting us come to your beautiful apartment and share with us these memories. It's no question in my mind why you have both succeeded in the business, because you're really terrific people.
Oh, and thank I think you. That, I'm sure after you leave, we'll think of a lot of things.
Oh, yeah. I'll think of a lot of things I could have asked you. But that's fine, because then the next time we can visit again and talk
some
more.
Well, we're delighted to see you and your lovely wife, Ellen, and to make a new friend.
Well, same here. Thank you both.
Thank
B. Wayne, Andre Baruch.